Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, hey, you're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and we're here at Roberta's Pizza as usual on a very mild fall day in Brooklyn. Today we're joined by a guest who came from quite a trek over to these parts, right. And I'm so happy for it. She came out with an amazing new cookbook just launched 2 days ago?
September 4th.
September 4th, a while ago, but she's just in town for a lot of events for the book. It's called Japanese Farm Food, and we have Nancy Singleton Hachiso, its author.
Hi.
Thanks so much for making it.
Sure. Glad to be here.
The concept of the book was something that surprised me, but also spoke to me so much because I love Asian flavors. Mm-hmm. I'm half Asian, and I love farm food. Mm-hmm. And, I think that when you think of modern day Japan, mm-hmm. the first image that probably comes to most people's minds is not a rural farm setting, perhaps.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I gather from your book and from others that I've read as well that farmers and the farming lifestyle is very revered in Japanese society.
Okay. I'm not sure I'd go that far.
Yeah.
I think of it as the backbone of Japanese society.
Yeah.
And I find it sad that it's, declining.
Right.
But there are younger people coming, trying to come from the cities to try their hand at it. And especially in our area.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not vilified by
it's
any
not.
Means.
Okay.
No, but
all right.
Revered might, I'm not going to go
there.
Yeah,
okay, got it. So. All right. Well, maybe when it comes to the purity of ingredients, which is
it's an ideal that people love to talk about, and they love to think about. And there's lots of cooking or food shows on TV, but it's like a life that's not part of their life,
right?
And so certainly really interested in it, but, just as easily can walk down the street and eat 7-Eleven food. No problem there.
What are those things you get out of the vat? The, what's it called? Those rubber kind of fishy balls.
Oden.
Oden.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that always looks really gross. And there's
that's
some
very far
thing on
from
top.
Farm food, I think. So about this because you've been living on a farm for the past 20 years in Japan.
24.
Mm-hmm. And your husband has had this farm in his family.
Mm-hmm. For many generations. I don't know how long. But I will say that, just because we're farmers doesn't mean we're growing. I mean, we are growing vegetables, but we're not selling vegetables. This is not the kind of farm that Japanese farmers traditionally, they had some sort of agrarian related job. In my husband's family's case, they had silkworms.
Mm.
And so that was their livelihood.
Right, yeah.
Right. And my husband now, my husband's father was doing some sort of chicken business. And then my husband switched it over to a free-range egg business. But
okay.
The Japanese farmer would always grow, farming family would grow their rice. And then in our area, the wheat for udon noodles that they ate every night for dinner. And then, a few crops. I mean, it's really standard crops,
right,
in the summer and winter for the family.
Right, like a farmstead or, yeah.
Yeah, so that's, but there's very few of those kind of farmers around, that model is rare.
Same as
here.
Pretty much anywhere, yeah.
Yeah, but there's, in America, there's been a real resurgence, it's a huge country, so mm-hmm. I don't know what percentage, but
that's
still.
That's true.
That part has still not really hit Japan.
Right. And you would be very keen to know about the resurgence here because you're from Berkeley, California.
Right? No, from Palo Alto.
Palo Alto.
Atherton, actually, but yeah. I was born in Palo Alto.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were in Berkeley for a while.
Nah, I just go to Berkeley a lot because of Chippenese and because of my friends, because we think the same way.
Yeah.
But yeah. I stay in Berkeley a lot.
Right. So it must have been quite a drastic change of pace because I've spent some considerable time in the Bay Area, but I'm from New York and we have some drastic seasons, but I imagine it's not nearly as drastic as the high temperatures in the summer and mm-hmm. then the freezing cold winters in Japan.
Well, you know, Japan's like the size of California and it has anywhere from LA to the Sierras in climate wise. So we're sort of in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really have, incredibly cold winters. We get one snow or two, and it doesn't stay on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But it's more that, all over the world, seasonality has sort of disappeared in many ways. You know, you can go to the supermarket any time of year in Japan as well and buy tomatoes, cucumbers, eggplant. And it's, zucchini, whatever, it's always there. And so the difference for me was it was mostly about eating from the farm, and saying, well, this is what we have and this is what we're going to eat. And, I'd have cooking classes and there was this organic vegetable company that was gathering. They would get vegetables sent to them. It was a friend of ours did this company and it was like a clearinghouse for organic vegetables. And so I'd say, well, I want to have, green beans on my cooking menu next month. And my husband would say, well, we won't have any. Well, these people will, and they're growing in Kyushu, so it's fine,
Mm-hmm.
But it was really just sort of a slow process of realizing that really whatever I have here and now, this is what I should be using, And it helped the whole cooking process,
What are some of the most drastic differences that you encountered when you first moved to Japan?
The drastic
cooking? Yeah.
And well, when I was first in Japan, I didn't have a fork and knife, and I only had chopsticks, and I only ate rice and tofu and vegetables. I was really trying to just, completely immerse myself in the food life, and I got this book called The Heart of Zen Cuisine. And then one other one was a home cooking book. I think I can't remember the name of the author. And I, had a little dinner party and I, made this Zen cooking, and everybody loved it. And, it was very unusual. Nobody had had it before practically. And then the next time I had a dinner party, I did the home cooking style, and I got lots of kibitzing and I just thought, why am I inviting my Japanese friends over for Japanese food? It's when I've only been here for like 2 months. It was sort of a crazy idea. So I continued to cook from what I saw on TV and just sort of a mishmash kind of thing of sort of quasi-Japanese food. But really when I had people over, I cooked Western food. I got this Southern cooking book by Lee Bailey, made fried chicken, never eaten it in my life, never cooked it in my life. But, I just did things like that I thought that they might like. And, really, my husband is a very good cook. And so I let him cook Japanese food because I was just his assistant. And then but over the years, I came to owning my own, So the food in the book is, really our family food, but it also it's certainly filtered through my taste because I'm not a farmer. I tried my best on the fields, but I'm not out there like at 5 a.m. like my husband, And so I like less salt, less soy sauce, and less oil.
Okay. I think it looks like a delicious cuisine that you've managed to come up with here.
Thank you.
It definitely suits my taste. I'm looking through your blog right now, our JapaneseFarmFood.com, and this is the simplicity of so many of them, but it's just, I think that it's really accessible. Stir-fried celery and red pepper with soy sauce.
Delicious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's great. And I don't know of too many people who stir fry celery other than Asian cultures.
Well, it's similar to a mountain vegetable we have called udo. We also are, we grow celery and our friends grow celery. And so, it just seemed like a good way to go. And
hand chopped mackerel with miso and chives.
That is so good.
That looks like a kind of like a
like a tartare.
Yeah, it's tartare. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah, but just flavored with miso. Yeah.
So a little French fusion there.
Let's not use the fusion word. That's exactly a Japanese dish.
Okay.
Completely not. Yeah.
No, not at all.
Not at all. No.
Is there some hesitation on the word fusion?
Let's just say I don't like that word. Yeah. And this is definitely not fusion food.
I hear that.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of the word either, yeah. But sometimes it slips. Right. So when you're saying that you first, when you tried to make the Japanese home style cooking for your friends in Japan, they were like, meh. Is it because most people actually
cooked?
They were
cooked? Like, it was just like they wanted to give me different pieces of advice. Well, we would make it like that. And we were like, you know, and it was just some of my girlfriends, you know. And then they got my husband, who was a friend at the time, involved, mm-hmm. you know, and it was a big discussion about how the method, right, you know, right. But there's no necessarily, it was a dish that I've never, ever seen called mizutake. It was a chicken nabe, and it's the restaurant food, really. And
okay. I've
never seen it in my life in Japan. Somebody had told me about it, you know.
Is there a large dichotomy between Japanese homestyle cooking and the restaurant foods?
Well, generally what you're going to have is... the food and people eat in Tokyo is restaurant food. That's what they eat at their house. Mm-hmm. So that's different difference. That's town food.
That's city
generated.
Food, I see.
It's generated from really restaurants. You
okay.
know? But you know, if you say restaurants in Japan, it's not like restaurants per se. I mean, there are restaurants, but there's lots of little teeny shops.
Got
you
it.
Know what we call, and there's little teeny shops where you can sit down and eat. You know.
But, at a stool or something.
Yeah,
in and a window.
So, right. So when you talk about there's so many restaurants in Tokyo, it's per capita. But I mean, it's more that there's really lots of teeny little shops. But the farm food is going to come from the field,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so you're going to have, you know, like when you have celery, you have a big thing of celery, you know. But you know, or carrots or greens, you know, you're just going to make a lot of one thing. It's not a lot of mixy matchy things.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
And you can use there's four salts. You know, you can use salt or soy sauce or miso or shotsuru, the Japanese fish sauce.
Or maybe braise it in a little dashi or something. But that's shochu.
That's just a different salt
method.
Flavor. We have
Got it.
Four salt flavors. So if you have dashi, you still have to have a salt flavor. Either you're going to put salt in or soy sauce or miso.
From Bonita.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So how did you get the concept for... When did you come up with the idea to write this book? Was it
A long time.
Percolating?
Yeah. I mean, I have several books that I want to write. And this was sort of a real back burner project. I was thinking I'd call it Japanese Men Cook because the only food I've really loved is my husband's and then my friend Kanchan, who's in the book a lot. But then I thought I was going to write, you know, like my food book in Japan and publish it in Japanese, you know, and it just became less and less appealing because, you know, translating into Japanese, it loses something. But, I mean, we're hoping this book will be translated into Japanese. But, and I also write about the life and it just sort of evolved and, it was David Leibovitz actually in Paris who... Blogger.
Came up with the idea?
Well, no, it wasn't come up with the, I mean, it was my...
Prompted the
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, he just said, if you live on an organic farm in Japan, then, you know, this is what you should be writing about. And I said, yeah, I guess everybody wants me to write this book, so I think I'll write this book.
Well, I'm very glad you did,
yeah.
too.
And it just really took on a life of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And I started photographing before I even wrote the proposal. I mean, I didn't photograph, but I got the photographer through a friend, and I just go with... my instincts, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how long did it take to write?
I don't know. The whole project was 2 years.
Right.
So it's not all one time. I did spend a very concentrated summer working on recipes.
Right.
I have a lot of stories hanging around. But the photography was over the course of 2 years. And
wow.
The photographer, Miura-san, he came back, you know, multiple times for parties, Thanksgiving,
okay.
you know, and
so
just it's really you can see the layers and the photography from that, you know.
I ask because this is one of the most kind of like really nurturing, like, you know, when you have a meal that is just so satisfying and so many different layers, different taste buds are all sated, and I feel like that way about your book because you get so much personal anecdotes span these 24 or some years.
Sometimes I was like, "Why am I writing too much?" I thought they were going to cut it.
Yeah, and it's not a, you know, it's not just a kind of like, I don't want to say careless, but less thoughtful marriage of Japanese cooking with other influences. It's just very rooted in there. So,
and the book itself, I mean, physically, like the cloth is from my house or from my friend Kim, who
it's beautiful. Could,
and then the pottery was, you know, except for the antique pottery, was all made by my husband or my sons. You know, so it was, and the calligraphy is my husband's. You know, so a lot of the design ideas were, you know, came out of my house and my stuff, and then and my ideas, and then the designer herself really put them on the page beautifully. You
it
know.
Sounds like a perfect way to express this food, because Japanese food is so visual too.
And there are way more photos than originally anticipated, but I just sent a lot of photos, and they, it was so hard to resist them.
It's hard to resist when you come across a page, when I'm looking at a cookbook, when I come across a recipe that doesn't have a photo in a book that has a lot of photos, it's like, whoa. Did a great job. Let's talk a little bit more about your upcoming events in New York City.
Okay.
And we'll have just a quick little musical interlude, and we'll be right back to chat with more with Nancy Singleton Hachiso.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Give me a reason to ask you all. Will you nod your head sideways? Since it's full of air on a man.
All right, that was a fun music break. We're back talking with Nancy Singleton Hachiso about Japanese farm food. Do check out the book. It's gorgeous to look at, and the recipes are exciting and new. And
thank you.
Yeah, I really am a big fan of it. Before we talk about your events, I have been struggling with this one cooking issue. And right now is a great time to start pickling because it's a harvest season. We have so much produce and not a whole lot of time before we're going to stop seeing some of our favorites. So perhaps a good time to start pickling. And I've tried to make nuka-zuke, the type that I love, that is...
I have some with me, not here, but in the hotel.
Okay. And that requires burying the vegetables after they've been salted heavily in a heavily salted rice bran called... What is it?
Nuka
That's
doko.
The nuka doko. Okay, in Japanese.
It's rice bran mash.
Rice bran mash.
Yeah, in
and
English.
There's a photo of you making the rice bran mash on your blog.
Yes.
It went moldy. I tried.
Okay, so did you read the recipe or have you...
I have Elizabeth Endo's book.
Okay, well, why don't you read my recipe? But
Got
I mean,
it.
Elizabeth
okay.
is a fabulous
is a while
person.
Ago. Yeah.
But, and she's an incredible... anthropology, you know, so much about Japanese food, so I'm sure the recipe is great.
That was in Washoku.
Yeah, Japanese so the thing is with the nuka doko, the rice bran mash, you have to mix it every day.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, it molds. And it gets, it gets a white bloom first. Mm. And if it's just a very light white bloom, you can fold it in.
Okay.
But if it's fairly white or if there's some weepy stuff, you scrape it off.
Okay.
And then, but you must aerate the whole thing. And then every single day. If you wait if you forget one day, it's maybe okay. 2 days, forget it. Just throw out the thing, you know.
Okay.
But it's a living thing, and it has to be. You can hold it, like when I'm traveling, I put it in Ziploc bags, and I tighten it up, and then I, you know, put it in Tupperware. It's not as happy that way, and sometimes you have to drain it out, but it's it has to be taken care of.
Okay, and what's the best way to mix it with, like, chopsticks, perhaps?
Your hand.
To fluff it up? Your hand? That's not
your
gonna
hand.
Help. Okay.
You need your hands when you're cooking.
I thought maybe I was giving it some
No. You need your, I mean, the hand will impart good things too, I think, you know. And,
okay.
And it also has to be completely flattened when you're done, and every single little component inside it, like the kombu, red pepper, all those kind of things have to go completely poked in.
Mm.
Nothing can be out.
Okay.
And I think it's happier in ceramic.
Okay.
But you
can't.
Right,
I'll
put
try
it in.
That. I had a glass or something.
Yeah,
like
that's
that.
Fine.
Okay.
But yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. So this pickle, how did the tradition start?
Ah, sorry. Oh,
that's all right. You okay? I imagine it
Crazy.
Was a byproduct, the rice bran.
Yeah, okay, so right. Okay. I mean, I polished 52 kilos of rice before I came here, and then I've got a bunch of rice bran.
Okay.
I had already started the my nuka, but I had polished some rice. But yeah, I mean, you polish your rice.
And then
you take the holes off. The machine takes the holes off, and then you've got brown rice there.
Right.
Okay. And then you put the brown rice is in a hopper, and it goes through the next place, and you get a drawer full of, we have a machine that's about the size of a washing machine.
Okay.
And then you get a drawer full of this fluffy nuka, rice bran, and then you add the salt water, you parch it, add the salt water, you add some aromatics and a miso.
Mm-hmm. Kombu maybe.
Well, that's not an aromatic. Aromatics would be miso, like sour orange peel and red pepper. And then you add the kombu for more flavor, depth of flavor, and also it gives some liquid off.
Okay.
And then you season it with the vegetables for like a week or two. And you really need a warm time to do it in. So that's an issue too. Like in Berkeley, it was a little bit harder. For one of the chef that did the dinner, she was Amy Densler, and her nuka I thought tasted good. But it did lack some sourness that was necessary. So if you put it in a warm car, that's gonna maybe do good.
That's a good idea.
And one
too
of my
bad
friends
I don't
thought.
Have a car.
Well, another friend thought that, you know, if proofing, like if you're get your oven warm enough for proofing bread, that might be a possibility. Huh. I haven't signed up on that one.
Okay.
Signed off. But yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it takes just practice and time and some years to
just
to
keep
get it
patient.
Finesse. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank
but
you.
But it's worth it.
For so much for the helpful tips.
Yeah.
What are other uses for that, the fluffy rice bran? I imagine compost or?
Compost. Yeah. I think that, and they also there's face washing.
Oh,
you know,
interesting.
But I mean, exfoliating. I don't use it, but yeah.
It's so fascinating to hear you kind of demystify the process of hulling rice.
Uh-huh.
It's like in the size of a washing machine. Like, really?
It blows it out the side of the garage door, or actually the farm thing.
That is so cool. So not only are you enlightening these aspects of food in the book, but you're also cooking a dinner coming up soon here in Brooklyn.
Well, Ken's cooking it at Marlowe
and Sons.
And I'm bringing some stuff and just sort of consulting, but basically, yeah.
Is it going to be recipes from the book?
Yes, some of the recipes are from the book, and some are like riffs off of the ideas in the book. You know,
okay. So using something that we have here.
So yeah, I've not. It's less than. It's not necessary. It's also what coming out of the chef's his or her own creative ideas.
Right.
And so I didn't want to really put my finger in too much, some of the dinners I cooked completely with. Some of them I wrote the menu. It's all been sort of a different thing.
Okay.
But so Marlowe will be, both the dinners are sold out, unfortunately, but they're at 8 o'clock tonight and tomorrow.
Read about them on the blog.
I'll write up those, but wait. And then Williams-Sonoma, 59th and Lex on Wednesday night.
Don't miss this week.
It's
open to the
5:30,
public.
Yeah, yep. Back in the cooking area. And then Brooklyn Kitchen You have to sign up online.
Mm-hmm. Reserve your spot now.
Right, and that's a demo also, but it's more food. And mm-hmm. I brought rice from our farm, my husband's rice, really delicious. And we'll have local vegetables, and I brought my homemade miso, organic soy sauce.
So do you know what you're going to cook?
I do. So at Williams-Sonoma, it's celery quimpira, the one from the book.
Oh, great.
I did it in Gloucester. It was a big hit. Mm-hmm. Maybe some, a miso Easter fry thing.
Okay.
I have to see what the vegetables are at the green market.
Sure.
And then at Brooklyn Kitchen, we're going to, because of the butcher shop,
the meat hook.
Yeah. I'm going to get thinly sliced pork belly and saute it with some rapini, just cooked rapini, and maybe a carrot miso salad, carrot rape, julienne cut, and then there was one other thing, and the rice, and something maybe, green beans with the Japanese fish sauce.
Oh, great.
Really, and ginger.
That sounds delicious. Mm-hmm. It's so simple, too. Yeah. A couple ingredients.
Right.
But in juxtapositions that I guess many people would not think of. Speaking of which, this is a gorgeous photo, too. On your blog, there's raw okra.
Oh, yeah. That is
with
really
bonita
good.
With bonita flakes and a little sprinkle of soy sauce. And I never thought you could eat
it
raw
is so
okra.
Good.
But it looks like cucumber slices almost. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's not as... Do you get that slime?
No, see, that's the thing. I think people that don't like the slime are going to like this.
Like that.
Yeah. I'm going to do that. I'm going to cook that at Bon Appetit tomorrow. Not cook it. Chop it.
Chop it for the photo?
Right. Yeah, I came with lots of knives.
There's no cooking.
Incredible, actually,
I'm going to try that as soon as possible.
Also, it's good with that kind of style is really good with raw asparagus.
Okay. Yeah.
Very, very thin. Not the season, but, mm-hmm.
Light leaf season. So I ask everyone on this show this question, and I imagine you'd be an expert on this. But what do you think is the ultimate date-worthy meal?
Date-worthy meal?
Yes.
in what way, shape, or form?
Everyone has a different take on that.
Okay, yeah. Well, I would say go to Chez Panisse, but that's in Berkeley.
Okay, so, that would be very nice.
Downstairs in Chez Panisse.
Okay.
I like to go to, for a date, I would go someplace where you don't have to choose. You just sit down.
Oh, omakase.
And that's why I like places like Chez Panisse. And I don't really know New York so well. We're going to Reynard tonight.
Reynard. I don't know. But I imagine the chef's tasting menu experience is pretty...
Yeah, I mean, you don't want to have to be choosing. When you have a date, you want to focus on the other person. And I've spent so many years traveling with my children, and they refused to read the menus, wherever we were. And so I had to repeat the menu over and over and over and over. I'm so happy. Just sit down. Give me some food, please. As long as it's good.
You're over it. That makes a lot of sense, actually, coming from, you sounds like you could whip up so many different things. It's like, okay, let me not think.
Yeah, right. Because the conversation every day in our house is, what's for dinner tonight?
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, who's cooking? Mainly, it depends. Now my husband's cooking. Not so happy about it.
So how do you think that this book will be received by so many of the... So much of the American public that has only seen a lot of the, sushi, teriyaki, perhaps, in Japanese food, as it were, in New York. In America.
Well, I really, really, really wanted to show Japanese food for the incredible simplicity that it can be, and that it is not often like this. This is not the kind of food that most people are eating, actually, And so that's why... we can do the book in Japan, because it's unusual for even for Japanese.
Yeah.
It's just the approach. It's really from our family and from my husband, and then also my way, the way I want to eat too.
Yeah.
And it's really, food that, it's a modernization of much older food, because they didn't use sugar before, but after the war, You know, people wanted sugar because they didn't have it during the war, and it was a way of treating your guests so well. Plus, the vegetables didn't taste as good because everybody was leaving the farm to go to Tokyo to do the companies, you know. Mm-hmm. So, and so I really wanted just to have it very, very simple and just very understandable and say, look, Japanese food is not so mysterious, mm-hmm. you know. It's just this is how it is. And in fact, Japanese people are not so mysterious. We're just, I mean, I'm not Japanese, but they're just the same as country people in France or Italy or Japan or America. They're all the same feeling.
Right.
They just, and there's not this big mystery. You don't have to worry about how you bow or what you do. Just be normal and they'll be normal, and they're not,
mm-hmm.
they're not, they don't have lots, I mean, they're just real people.
Right.
You know, so yeah. That's kind of what I wanted to portray is like, it's just a normal thing, but there's Absolutely. So much mystique about Japan that's
and
like
you don't need
crazy.
To have an arsenal of strange imported sauce mixes.
No, you should not.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, amen to that. I'm very excited to, you know, cook more things from your book.
And one of the most exciting things that's come out for me is that, you know, at several of these venues, I've had Japanese Americans come up to me or like raise their hand in the audience and say, you know, this is the food that my grandparents or my great grandparents brought over from Japan in the teens. And mostly was in California, Washington, Oregon, that area.
Oh, wow.
And they were farmers when they came, and they made their own miso, and they made their own soy sauce, and they made their own natto. And we've lost that food in our family. And so we are so grateful that you wrote this book. And, you know, okay, my tears are falling, you know. But that is real. And they buy
amazing.
Five books at a time.
That is amazing.
Seriously. I mean, that just really was special for me.
Wow.
You know?
Wow.
So
cheers
happy about
to that.
That.
Congrats. It's a lovely cookbook. Everyone, check it out, please. Japanese Farm Food. Come visit Nancy at Williams-Sonoma on Wednesday or, you know, anywhere. Check out that website for the whole list of tour appearances this fall. Thanks again, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Kathy.
Thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Let's Eat In.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.